This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salatu wassalamu ala rasulillah, ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Welcome back to Behind the Minbar, Blueprints for a Better Masjid. I think that's what we called it.
Sounds good.
Imam Tom, it's awesome meeting you for the first time in my life.
Yep, mashallah.
You know, I'm pulling up here. I open YouTube and there's a podcast that just aired between me and you. It's just I feel bad for the internet, I guess.
We should go on tour. We should just like skip onto every single podcast. We'll have you on Utica Masjid. We're on Yaqeen already. We'll be on yours.
No.
What else?
You,
can we
not
do?
Me.
Thinking Muslim, we can go on. Just keep on going.
Inshallah.
Just tag team.
Allah barik fik, Sheikh.
No.
Man, I'm. But, you know, some of them are for wider consumption. And I believe a discussion like this, inshallah, will be for a tighter audience with deeper impact, inshallah, across generations. So welcoming our viewers, in case this is their first time, we are trying to think about our communities lovingly and critically at the same time, trying to strike that balance, trying to figure out for everyone that's involved or wants to get involved in Islamic work or community work in particular, masjid orientation or, you know, Muslim-oriented for the most part, how can we do better? How can we play catch up a little faster? How can we even develop the infrastructure that goes unnoticed and then the costs arise later in terms of us trying to scale and grow and be more efficient? I guess to set the stage for this episode, inshallah, which will be about religious leadership in our masajid, religious leadership in our centers. The first two episodes we spoke about when masjids disappoint, just like a high level on, you know, why people get disillusioned and where we must think of ways to level up. The second episode was the costs. It was a double clicking on the very real, you know, travesty and tragedy of people drifting from the masajid, or actually what goes unnoticed is the vast majority never enter to begin with in the Western context, in the American Muslim context. So inshallah, we wanted to speak about religious leadership. And it's a tough one, to be honest. Not just because the challenges are so many, but because one of the blind spots I think a lot of people have when trying to better their centers is the idea of what is the perfect model. And without turning this into like a management discussion, we're going to have a lot of those on with like subject matter experts, inshallah. Mm-hmm. But there is no perfect model, right?
Yeah, it's very like locally determined.
Yeah, and
site-specific.
Phase, right?
Yep,
like,
yep.
Do we have resident scholar? Are we talking about like a religious director? Are we talking about like a pastor type figure, imam, or just a preacher? Or because like I remember, maybe this is a good stat to set the stage and sort of get you to, inshallah, open up for us. These articles, you know, going around, I saw one from Politico and otherwise, they say there's an aggravated sense, there's a crisis among American Muslim mosques due to a shortage of imam, an aggravated shortage of imams, where more than half of the mosques don't have a full or a part-time imam. But check this, they say, they define this as, this has masajid scrambling Friday morning for a khatib. And I'm like, wait, what? That's like, that's how low the bar is right now. Like an imam just means someone who's there 20 minutes a week or 30 minutes to, you know, share a few inshallah inspiring words. And so what's
That's actually not what's happening. And it was the article written by Muslim or non-Muslim?
I believe it wasn't by Muslim.
Yeah, well, you can tell because, you know, the masajid find a way to have a khatib. And that's part of the problem, right? Because there's a bunch of people who are non-trained, non-professional sort of people who can step in for a khutbah. But it really, you know, I think sheds light on all the other things that an imam is expected to do, that they really are, they feel it, or they feel the pain. It's really and it is a frenzy. I mean, honestly, you know, you and I are in WhatsApp groups. We see the job descriptions that are thrown around. And I think at the same time, not only did Masajid wake up to the fact that a lot of people are leaving Islam, you know, to say nothing of the people who never come to the Masajid, like you've already covered, but even the people that come to the Masjid, a lot of the youth, we're losing a lot of the youth, first of all. And a lot of masajid are waking up to the fact that it can't just be one person, right? Which gets into some sort of like expectations of what is the imam position, what was it back home, what should it be here, etc., etc. So it's like those two things happening all of a sudden. Masajid artists, yeah, we do feel the scramble. I feel the scramble. I see every week, you know, different job openings, imam. I just got yesterday, like somebody, you know, of all the masajid I've toured, I think 70% of them, just like to pull a random number, like definitely over half of them have offered me a position. And I'm more than fully employed. I'm 1.5 employed,
yeah.
Right? So the need is dire. It's dire. It's dire. But that doesn't necessarily mean, because, you know, you and I are also in many, you know, circles and groups of stuff of tulab al-ilm and stuff like that, other imams. And a lot of folks, they're either turning up their nose at, and that's not them, that's like just like what it is, like they're not impressed with the masajid, what they're offering, first of all, don't see it as realistic, or there's tulab al-ilm or imams that are trying to get out of it, you know. And yeah. I'm like maybe half of one, like, you know, like I sympathize with that because of all the sort of institutional approach to what or confusion around what religious leadership should be. So there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah.
There is, you know, I used to remember being of those who parroted like, we need, you know, better khatibs, we need people who speak better English, and, you know, not as much of an accent, and all that is true. All that is true. But in hindsight, I remember the person who sort of looped me into the masjid was a person who could not speak a lick of English.
Mm-hmm.
It was just them being available for me with a little bit of like a language barrier. But and it reminded me the difference between like a preacher and a pastor, mm-hmm. right? A pastor is, are people going to think I'm sort of...
Right,
the shepherd. In a different doctrine, yeah, yeah, the shepherd, yeah, of the humans, shepherd.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So the pastor is the person who cares and goes out looking for people, as opposed to just someone who's there. If you come my way, I got something to say to you.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, it you know, it tickles a good spot inside you. Big difference, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not the imam is not just someone to share some charisma, or the priest is not is someone who you come to for the confession, whereas mm-hmm. the pastor is the one that goes out,
right?
You know, subhanAllah, it got me thinking about the hadith, Sheikh, of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, when he's speaking about the qualifications of an imam, like just prayer imam, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, most Quran, most Sunnah, you know, first to make hijrah, if not in the eldest of them, seniority in age. And then he says at the end, and this sort of supersedes all, he says, وَلَا يُؤَمَّنَّ الرَّجُلُ الرَّجُلَ فِي سُلْطَانِهِ. But no one is to lead in the domain of someone else. And so like the staple imam,
right,
is the more entitled than even the guy with the nicer voice, the guy with the more charismatic recitation. And that's profound.
And you find that,
right?
You find that in masajid. You know, you find like a leader, you know, who's been there, who's put in the work, that has the sort of, you know, top dog sort of thing, and they don't have the most Quran memorized.
Yeah.
Or they're not, you know, absolutely perfect tajweed.
And so why aren't there imams in that sense, in the pastoral sense, in masajid? So like if we are scrambling to find khatibs, then we even have less everywhere we go. Everyone's mm-hmm. offering job offers. I think, yes, the masajid are bleeding talent because they're not qualified to retain talent. And mm-hmm. we're going to talk about that, inshallah, in detail in this episode and otherwise. But also, the masajid, I would say, and you can agree, disagree, or compliment, because I know there's many reasons, but the masajid also are misreading qualification.
Oh, big time.
Right?
Yeah,
like you said, you want someone there to gut it out. The non-glamorous role, part or full-time, is far more important than someone who's going to, you know, woo the crowd. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but woo the crowd in a nice way momentarily and then disappear.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's say iman boosters, or, you know, what some people call vanity metrics, right? Yeah. And there's even now that in the age of social media, you know, some of the bigger masajid, they look at stuff like how many followers do you have? You know, how many whatever subscribers do you have on YouTube and things like that. And that's really, really strange, right? It shows, and I know we're going to get there, so I don't want to jump the gun, but like what are all the different sort of things that we're hoping out of religious leadership? Because reach is one thing,
yeah,
right? But it's one thing among many things. You also need longevity, sustainability. You know, you need somebody who, like you said, somebody who's going to go out to the people and somebody who's going to be there for people when they come in.
That's one reason, right?
Yeah.
One reason why there isn't enough religious leadership in our masajid is because we are misreading qualifications.
Yeah, definitely.
We think it's settling when in fact it could be the more important factors, right? Someone that's in it for the long game, willing to mm-hmm. sacrifice themselves. Why are other reasons you think that you find masajid resistant to hiring or hiring faster? Or
even masajid that make it a priority to hire somebody who's going to stick around don't always give an ecosystem where someone's going to stay around.
Okay.
And that's the other thing too. Whether that has to do with empowering a leader, you know, it's famous that a lot of masajid totally micromanage their religious leadership, butt in to religious decisions where they have no business talking about anything. You know, undermine sort of, and even humiliate, like, to be honest, like, to some of the stories that I've been made aware of, like, actually humiliate their religious leadership and then expect people to stay around. You know, it's like, yeah, it's just not going to happen like that. You know, there's, and I could tell a lot of stories, you know, because, you know, just from the other imams and the colleagues sort of that we have, you know, for example, there was one imam I know that I was in the Jamia with. And yeah, I'm not going to say where they're at, but you know, the expectations, first of all, are unrealistic, especially for somebody who has a family. Okay, so you know, 5 prayers a day, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. Okay, one morning he is on his way out the door to go to his car to get to Fajr. Okay. And there are fire trucks, like the alarm in the fire alarm in his apartment building was like going off, and fire trucks had come to the building, okay? And the fire truck is blocking him from leaving. All right, so he gets to the masjid like, you know, 15 minutes later, whatever. They already prayed. You know, the director, executive, once he hears about it, because they usually don't go to Fajr, that's another problem, you know, says like, where were you? Okay, he explains the whatever. And then the response is, you should have left earlier.
Right.
Right. That's typical behavior, right? You've got other masajid, other talabalim I know that are imams. There's somebody in every community. And the thing is, you know, we have to stick up for each other, because for us, we take the spiritual training and we're like, tawadu, and we're like, you know, yep, I'm going to take it, and this is just my qadr, and like, whatever.
But then you don't. You file out of the masjid.
Yeah, it's just very discouraging, or it starts having you look at the exit sign, right? Like, there's like, you know, and I've faced a little bit of this in my community, but I know somebody else who faced it way more, where somebody is just like harping on every single religion. They just have, they think they know, and they like are really just like not, they don't even have the tools to have an argument about whether it's a fiqh opinion or whether it's a decision the imam makes, you know, has to do with within like his expertise, you know, and they're just going to like hammer it and hound this person and like office hours and text messages and emails and stuff like that.
Gaslighting.
And it's like, you know, at some point, when is the board going to step in for the mental health of the imam, right? And be like, you're out of line. This is our imam. He's entrusted to these things. He knows better than you do. So shut up, right? How many masajid do you know that would do that? Maybe, I don't know. Count them on one hand.
Yeah.
You know, but seriously, so it's we're talking about an ecosystem, right? Because it's like, and there's several different ways in which it's an ecosystem. It's an ecosystem that the imam needs support. The imam needs to be protected. The imam needs to be able to have like goals and aspirations and be facilitated towards those aspirations and grow. Right, like mentorship and continue learning and stuff like that, all these sorts of things. And so if what happens too often is the masjid, you know, let's say they get their, you know, the who they want with their qualifications, turn over the keys, like you're on your own, bismillah, you're going to be sort of empowered sometimes, you know, empowered enough to get the blame when things go wrong at least.
Yeah,
you know, and then act surprised when he wants to move on in 2 or 3 years, it gets run into the ground or, you know, burnout or things like that. So,
you know, I met a brother who's actually a consultant for nonprofits. It's like a childhood friend of mine, actually. We crossed paths at Mass Ikna last December in Chicago, and I almost wish he didn't turn my attention to something. He said, Muhammad, have you noticed how stroll through the bazaar, almost all the founders, presidents of relief organizations are former imams?
Allahu Akbar. Wow.
And then I stopped for a second and I ran them through my head and I said, oh my God. Of course, this is honorable work.
Yeah, of course.
And we need more of it.
Right.
But why did they take it up? Because they bled out of the masajid.
Of course.
The masajid was just, I'm not productive here.
Yeah.
Let me be productive somewhere else. Yeah. And I was like, my goodness, why? And then I recall so many horror stories. And yeah, I know one imam. We should not mention too many of these stories. You're right. Let's move on, because you did touch on so many important points. He tried his level best 10 years ago to insulate his community from divisive subjects. Mm-hmm. Arab Spring 10 years ago. Oh, everyone sort of like,
man.
The firestorm was imported within these American Muslim communities, right, from the Middle East. And every time people would bring questions his way, he did his level best to not share his opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Till like one time, a leadership figure in the masjid publicly calls him out and tells him, is this president Muslim or not? And so he sort of had to gently, but how gently can you, dismiss the question. And so shortly thereafter, behind closed doors, among sort of a handful of people, that same person asked the imam to go make him a cup of tea.
Oh.
Deliberate humiliation, right? Oof. Go make me a cup of tea. He's just, you know, making a point here.
Yeah.
And the imam walked out. He said, you know, I don't need to be here. I never wanted to be an imam my whole life. I've been leading Taraweeh since I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I have a master's degree in Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an entrepreneur.
Yep.
I've been doing import-export all over the globe before sort of things got complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's maybe to your point of what is the imam? Like, isn't he an employee? Yeah, sort of. He is an employee in the sense that he's on payroll. He better be on payroll if you think that, you know, someone can sort of, you know, eat and drink ayat and hadith,
right? Yeah.
In the wrong sense, of course. I know there's a hadith about the end of time, but that sort of hyperbolic, misunderstood notion that defies Allah's cosmic order and doesn't respect, you know, the laws of nature. This is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And no, they're accepting a salary because they're forced to accept a salary.
Yes.
And the brother, actually, the consultant, said to me, "You know who stays in the masajid now? Those who can't do anything else." And I was like, ouch.
Yeah, that hurts.
So all these people that are bleeding, it's because they know they can do better in dunya and deen.
Yeah.
Right? And so
No health insurance, no like whatever, like most masajid.
Like I'm accepting a lower salary.
Yep.
Right? And everything that comes with the job of chaos that we should get to in a second, because that's part of empowerment, right? Uh-huh. How do I empower to actually feel like, because they believe in the mission.
Yes.
You know, Umar ibn al-Khattab, radiallahu anh, when Abu Bakr became the Khalifa, the Imam, right, of the Muslims, he caught him in the market. He said, what are you doing? He said, the family of the Khalifa needs to eat.
Mm-hmm.
He said to him, the affairs of the Muslims and the affairs of the Khalifa's family can never be reconciled.
Mm.
And he forced him to take a salary so that he could dedicate himself for the Ummah.
Yeah.
And beautifully, of course, Abu Bakr radiallahu anh had, he slipped a fast one past Umar. He had his estate dedicated elsewhere in case he over consumed those pennies he was getting. May Allah be pleased with Abu Bakr. But that's the idea, right? We're forced to take, we don't want to take, so many of us. It is really a passion. It's not a profession.
Yes.
Yes, on payroll, because it needs to be, but I'm here for a mission. What is that mission, Sheikh?
But, and I'm just going to put out real quick, if you look at the org chart, not that most masajid have org charts, but for those who do.
Yeah, what's this org chart?
So an org chart is supposed to give you a bird's eye view breakdown of like how, like what's the reporting, what's the structure, what's the hierarchy, like whatever.
Workflows, yep.
Workflows, all these sorts of things. Like, so that's a whole other problem about how, you know, incompetent might be a harsh word, but like, lacking competence. Let's a little bit nicer.
Primitive, yeah.
Most masajid are. But if you were to draw up like just a de facto org chart of most masajid, the imam would be on the same level as the maintenance guy. that's how they're treated. Most, when it comes to like viewing them as an employee.
And it needs more nuance than that, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, so, you know, and this happened actually in our masjid, right? It's like the imam doesn't know if he has a vote on the executive committee or what his sort of leadership is. And a lot of times it's informal. Well, you know, whatever. It's like, okay, well, let's like get some clarity here. And then someone will pipe up and say, well, he's an employee, just like the guy who takes out the trash. Right? It's like, well, strictly speaking, legally.
No disrespect to the guy taking out the trash.
No disrespect to him, yeah. But it's like, you know, I thought that you wanted to hire that person as a community leader and somebody who actually would guide, right? And you're saying he can't have a vote because he receives some sort of pay for it. I mean, that's a whole other issue. But it's structural.
So it's an existential issue, right? Like, I want to structure my organization, right? If we have sort of management people listening to us or masjid volunteers or leadership listening to us, I want to structure my place based on the objectives of my place. What is the objective of this place? Is this place, what does existence mean? Existentially, is it a social center or is it sort of a religious institution? Right. So a religious institution, it has to be religiously informed.
That's right.
And so many of our masajid problems would get solved if they were religiously informed.
Yes.
Does our deen not offer solutions? You know, subhanAllah, I think of the sisters issue, right? Our sisters get the short end of the stick in so many masajid.
Yeah.
Right? This hadith actually has two benefits related to the discussion. The hadith of Aisha radiallahu anha in Bukhari, when longer hadith, she's asking him why the Kaaba is a square, not a rectangle. Yeah, he said, "Inna qawmaki daqat bihim unnafaqa," your people, like they ran out of money. And so they created the Hijr to, you know, account for the rest of the true borders of the Kaaba. So you make tawaf around that for a full, complete circling of the Kaaba, tawaf. But then he said, she told him, or he said to her, and they raised the door of the Kaaba in the reconstruction so that Quraysh could be a gatekeeper and let into the Kaaba who they want and keep out of the Kaaba, exclude from the Kaaba who they want. And then he said, and were your people not recently disbelievers, O Aisha, I would have tore down the Kaaba and rebuilt it upon its original parameters, the original foundation of Ibrahim alayhi salam. And so, like, in the one sense that he's informing how the Kaaba should be.
Yeah.
You direct that. And in the other sense, he's also the best, the religious leadership, though the inheritors of prophetic guidance, they're directing on how gradual the process should be, what priorities should be, but not right now. This is right and wrong, and we're going to pick our battles because that's what the Prophet taught us. But if you never open up to the Imam, what's the vision? What's the trajectory? Where should we be? Yep. What should it look like?
Yeah, major plan, strategic planning. Right? That's the thing. And that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, the need is so great. And maybe we'll talk soon about, you know, the different expectations for an Imam, quote unquote, back home versus here in North America. You know, that oftentimes the need is so great, the programming needs are so great that the Imam is so engrossed in daily activities that he has no opportunity even to look up and see, like, what's our 3-year plan, what's our 5-year plan, what's our 10-year plan, where are we going?
So even if the management had empowered him theoretically, the overburdening of the workload doesn't actually allow that.
No, and that's where some masajid are starting to wake up and they're starting to recognize that it does not, it's not possible that one person can perform this job, that you need, you know, somebody, at least one person to handle sort of day-to-day execution and another person to be involved in strategic planning and sort of, you know, see the roadmap and things like that. But the other thing is that, you know, I think a lot of masajid, they have trouble when it comes to their governance and their sort of executive leadership stepping back once they do have an imam. Because, you know, a lot of times you have the scrambling masajid or whatever. They make do. They have their khatibs and they have their processes and stuff like that. But then it's almost like they don't recognize that, well, okay, if you've been thinking, well, we want this imam, we want an imam, then you get the imam. Well, that's the time to step back, right? If you trust them, if you did your due diligence, you did your homework, and the person is obviously respect needs to be earned and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, a lot of times those structures that were sort of, stopgap solutions continue. Right. So now you have, and I think that leads to a lot of imams being sort of undercut and undermined as well, because now you've got, you know, yes, the imam should be involved in strategic planning and should have a say in, in what are the priorities of the organization? What are we fundraising for? Do we have any capital projects? Like, you know, all these sorts of things, you know. And if, you know, the leadership kind of understands that, well, that's our terrain only, right? Then, okay. And maybe there's a situation.
So what's his terrain only?
Yeah, exactly. That's,
I found that effective at least.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in sort of a rhetorical sense. I mean, fine, okay, this is your job,
yeah,
and I will have lesser involvement there as a religious leader.
Mm-hmm.
What is my job?
Yes.
And you will have lesser involvement
right.
there as an administrative leader. Because there has to be sort of like a social contract, right?
Yeah,
between
yeah.
us. Every org is going to have to figure out their own solution at every phase in their journey.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to my masjid, and I don't mean that we have the ideal or anything, but I found it useful that I stipulated for myself a condition and for them a condition. I said to them, listen, on the administrative front, anything that is not clearly haram, like categorically, you know, a matter of unanimous agreement mm-hmm. between the scholar or something, I will not touch it. Mm-hmm. I will not impose my training,
right.
my legal training within a particular school of Islamic law on you.
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm.
not my place. Mm-hmm. If they're all going to say it's wrong, I'm going to have a veto anywhere in the organization, because this yep. is a religious organization.
MashaAllah.
And they accepted that. And I said, I will stipulate for you, I will stipulate for myself that on the religious front, the pastoral, educational front,
mm-hmm.
I'm making those determinations, and unless it's like categorically illegal in the local laws and I'm oblivious to that,
right.
or you guys all agree that this is going to cause a meltdown and sort of jeopardize the longevity of the organization itself or its mm-hmm. survival, you don't have a veto.
Yeah.
It's not yours.
Yeah.
If it's truly that dangerous, then you need another religious director.
Yep.
But so long as I'm here, you're going to have to defer to me, or else... I mean, this is just ABC's business, right? You
yeah.
don't hire smart people to tell them what to do.
Right.
So the administration is assumed to be smarter or yes. more available
yes.
or more competent to do the administration. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
The religious leadership should be assumed and mm-hmm. trusted as more competent and available and dedicated to that front. You know, Sheikh, I want to ask you about other reasons why people are not interested in hiring to begin with, and then we'll circle back, if you don't mind, to the
yeah.
empowerment factors.
Yeah.
I've heard people openly say, we don't want the headache of an imam. Like, it's just meddling, right? Why do I want
yeah.
someone to come here and tell me halal and haram and all this
yeah.
other stuff? And just let him come. I'll give him his gas money. Give me my khutbah and just take a hike.
Yeah,
they don't use that term.
Yeah.
But.
Well, a lot of people, they also want the masjid back home, right? Like they consider that the masjid is just for the prayers, maybe a tahfidh.
Some nostalgia.
Yeah. And then that's like all it is. You know, you start having too many young people making noise, too many converts, weird people, weird looking people off the street, you know, open houses, things like that. You know, people always complain. Right, they think, oh, this is the masjid. Like the masjids are for Allah. Like this is, you know, for Salah. And there's a wedge there. There's a point, but a lot of people have a very very narrow understanding about what.
It's not a place for growth and change and challenge.
Yeah, education exactly. Because and we were talking about this, you know, off camera. It's like, you know, what is the masjid in Medina or the masjid in you know Cairo or whatever. It's locked most of the day, and then the muezzin comes and opens it up, except for the big masajid that people like, you know, go for, you know, to visit. But you know, the normal adi masjid is opened up for prayer time, and then the imam rolls in and the iqama sounds, and you pray your prayers, and after asr he reads a hadith, and then everybody goes home. And they rely on the sort of, you know, inheritance of culture and the extended family units and all the other things that people take for granted, quote unquote, back home to do the other stuff. Like
so
the
imam
marriage
in
counseling
that case is seen as the disruptor of what I'm used to and what feels good.
They just don't see it as necessary.
Yeah.
They don't see the value that's added.
It's intrusive.
Yeah. It's like, why would we want to be doing anything other than why have all this sort of stuff in the masjid? The masjid is just a masjid. And in reality, that's
un-Islamic and short-sighted.
Yeah.
How long is that going to last, right?
Oh, very, very, you know, and that's why more people are waking up and more institutions are realizing that, yeah, that's not going to work. Like as people flee from Islam or, you know, leave Islam in droves.
Let me represent for a second those who may be listening who are maybe earlier in their startup of religious institutions, centers, masajid, who fear the cost of hiring an imam. I get this one a lot as well.
Oh, sure.
It's like, yeah, no, we can't hire an imam right now. When the community grows a little bit, we're going to hire an imam.
Yeah. Build it and they will come. And that's what it is, right? It's like the imam is the one who's going to add the most value to your community. Personnel always, right? Like much more than having people will go out of their way to pray in a cramped masjid where there's no space, so they have to pray outside or whatever. If the khutbah is going to be good and relevant and stick with them and they feel like it's going to add value to their lives. If they can come to the salah and have a cathartic experience with their creator and things like that, like that's what people, you know, to use a phrase, it's not literally true, but will pay good money, right? And they'll vote with their feet, you know? And we saw this, honestly, in Utica because it's important. The masjid has to be professional. Right, the services have to be professional and professionalized, and the first thing that you have to professionalize is the imam position, because the level of khutbah that you're going to get from any ammu is going to be inferior in general to something that somebody who has training. Yeah. It's just normal, right? And we've seen people like in our neck of the woods like vote with their feet, you know, if there's, you know, once we started, like we start getting a ton of people. Right, just because, you know, if the khutbah is going to be nice, it's going to be relevant, it's going to be professional, it's going to be in English, the youth are going to understand it, right? People show up and people actually become attracted to it. And if the donors need to be convinced, then that's going to raise your donations. That's going to do all this other stuff. That's not necessarily the only reason why you want to do it, but there's nothing, you know, you're not adding value to anybody's lives if you don't have a professional imam. That's just the, you know, so what growth?
So even if
what growth are you waiting on? What growth are you waiting on to hire an imam? And then here's the thing too. It's like, you know, hiring an imam is like paving the roads, right? Mm. If the government makes it a priority, they find a way to pave the roads.
Yeah.
If the government doesn't make it a priority, they'll always have an excuse to not do it. It's the same thing. You know, it's like, do you ever like not buy food? Do you ever like not eat? No, it's a priority. So you find a way, right? And that's what it is, you know?
So to see it as crudely a generator of funds, bottom line, right? Is important paradigm shift for a lot of people. And I always tell them this, that, you know, I our ummah has money, let alone those who came here for the milk and honey. That rhymes.
Yes, I am.
No, I didn't mean that. Mashallah. But let alone here in the American Muslim context, right? We have money, but there's a trust issue. There's a professionalism issue. Mm-hmm. There is, like, where do I want to put my money? Where I see value.
Yeah.
And that is why, you know, we, inshallah, will have a few episodes on, like, fundraising strategies and hacks and otherwise. But ABC's donor cultivation. Cultivate your donors. Mm-hmm. People donate based on relationship. People donate because they were approached. They were asked. Yep. They trust more than just, you know, there is a vision for the future,
yes.
Believe it or not.
Yes.
An assumed promise about build it and they will come and they will fund it and they will they will ask to.
Yeah.
It's extremely interesting. And so the cost calculation or cost hesitancy of hiring religious leadership. And you said, like, if you prioritize it, you'll just do it.
Yeah.
You're going to tease me now into saying, who said hiring one religious leader now is all you need?
Yeah.
I often tell people, have you ever seen a hospital run on one doctor?
No, it's impossible. They'll find the money.
Let alone a hospital with no doctors.
Listen, how quick do they find the money for other things? That's just hadahua, right? Like, just look at that. If it comes to a facility, it comes to a building, it comes to a chandelier, it comes to whatever, you know.
Somehow
they find the money. So it's just they're not prioritizing it, and it has to be a priority. And most of the time, people don't prioritize it until they have kids and their kids start to be teenagers and they see them drift away from Islam. Now all of a sudden they wake up. Oh, darn. I need someone who's going to relate to my kid, who's going to do what. And then you're behind the ball because your kid's 12, 13, 14, 15, and you're bringing somebody in. Alhamdulillah, finally, but it's too late. And now it takes time to develop programs. It takes time to build capacity, all these sorts of things. You know, you had to prioritize it from the beginning. And, you know, your priorities, you know, put your money where your mouth is.
Taken. So let me not break my promise. Let's go back to empowering the imams.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke about delineating for them what is their jurisdiction, yeah, and knowing where the employer is not to be wearing the employer hat, yeah, right? Yes, you are paying the pay. That's fine. And we should have episodes on imams and imam salaries and all that stuff.
Oh, because, yeah,
The calculation mechanism, even from employers, is, I think, laughable. A lot of times, average imam will make like 60K, 60K yeah, without medical insurance, 60K without a retirement
plan. We're
way
below the
60K, irrespective of where, you know, yeah, in the country and sort of the cost of living. And that's just like another issue. But that's the employer's job to figure out what makes sense to hire the right talent. You got to pay the right dollar. And, you know, but empowering them in other ways. How do we empower the imam so that they don't feel like the sacrifice I'm making is fruitless anyway? So let me stop making it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's so many things. I think taking the imam's mental health into consideration is a huge thing that most masajid don't do. And what does that mean? A few things. It means, one, that the masjid has to defend the imam from assailants and people who would, and that's not just
you mean the
physical,
guy who emailed me about shooting me?
Yes, not just physical assailants, but mental and spiritual assailants, because there are people, and everybody knows it, like you see after Jummah, after the khutbah, there are people that will just hound the imam about madrash, you know, this, that, or the third. They have no principles, they have no edab, they have no manners, whatever. There needs to be someone in every masjid that's going to take the imam, said, hey, there's a phone call for you, and escort him out of that room as quickly as possible and get him to a safe location, right? In addition to everything else, like people, you know, office hours, keeping regular hours, you know, protecting the imam's work-life balance, right? Something that most of us don't have at all, right? So it's like, when are you able to have time for your kids and a weekend and time off, and it's times where you can just completely shut down your phone. Give him a work phone. Give the imam a work phone. Give him a burner flip. We got those flip phones or whatever. Give him one with a separate number. It's going to be on from 9 to 5 or whatever. That's where you call for questions, okay? You don't hit up the imam on WhatsApp or on his personal number, right? These sorts of things. People pass around the imam's number like it's like, you know, halwa at the masjid. Just like, you know, pass around sweets, you know? And then everybody's got a problem. Everybody thinks they're the only person with a problem. Ya akhi, there's 300, 400, 500 people with problems. Your marriage is falling apart. Your kid is having doubts. Your whatever. Wallah, every single person. Yeah. It's not possible. The imam, it's not possible. You're smiling.
I remember pulling up to my masjid kind of recently. Great guy. In case he hears this podcast.
Right?
No, I know. He's so many stories, but like, you got to censor.
Yes.
No, he really is an elder. He'll never hear this podcast in a million years. His kids might show it to him. But people, and I say that really because people have such a lofty regard, the average person, for imams.
Mm-hmm.
It's unrealistic, mm-hmm, and they don't know it's unrealistic, right? I remember pulling up to my masjid. I had just landed from somewhere, drove 2 hours to get to Jummah on time, just scrambled, alhamdulillah, got there in time. I give the khutbah. I have to get home. Exhausted. I just need a shower. I just need to see my kids. I just, so many things are behind. And he just comes at me in the mihrab. And he's like, Sheikh, you need to come to my house right now.
Allah.
And I'm just like, why? He's like, it's a big problem. Fight with my daughter and her husband. I'm like, all right. I really was considering. I was like, oh man, this is serious. Like, he's not that type, by the way. He's not the type that hounds.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man, this is really serious. And then I was just like, what kind of problem is it? He's saying, you know, they're not seeing eye to eye. And so, like, she left the house and now he's sort of like taking the kids and he's saying he's not going to bring them back on Monday in 3 days. And I'm just like, what? That's a police problem.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Like, if I go there, I'm going to get beat up or arrested.
Same thing happened to me, actually.
Oh, why would I even try?
Yep. Someone came
up. So the assumption because of their fretting is just.
Yeah, no, it's true. Someone, they didn't have a car. They got someone else to give them a ride, knock on my door, right? My husband took the kids. He's not letting me see him. I said, call the police. Call a lawyer. Like, I don't have any, like,
executive force.
Illa, yani, a dua. Like, I don't have any ability to help you right now.
Yeah.
Like, but it doesn't compute. You know, and then times that by 300, you know, and that's the
So I have a theory, Sheikh. I want you to either like sign on or shut it down.
Okay.
So human nature,
yeah.
People go to God between rock and a hard place. When you're stuck, you rush back to God, even if you're not Muslim, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The sheikh is like the placeholder for God in the social sphere, right? He's sort of the guy who's going to tell me how to access God, how to get say my prayers, and God's going to fix everything. And
yeah.
So they only come with the problems, by the way.
Yeah,
right?
No, that's true.
Like,
that's
I know true. This one brother, he, like, I didn't snap, but I really wanted to. He came to me, he said, like, I just divorced my wife, da 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 da. And then, okay, we go through the motions, we figure it out with it. Then he disappears again. Right?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Then he comes back, he's like, Sheikh, problem. Just, you know, I divorced my wife, da da da. And so we figure it out. Yes, it does count. You know, he goes home, right. Reconcile. You guys got to be careful. And he comes back. I was like, bro, you need to listen to me, okay? Yeah. First of all, you've approached me 3 times in 2 years,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yes.
All of them after you divorced her.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That means you kissed and made up. I don't mean that literally, but yes, it's that's what married people. And I'm still there like, Ya Rabbi, fix his marriage.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't get the memo that you guys are doing better. I'm doing horrible.
That's
I'm
right.
carrying it
emotionally. About, yeah, of course.
These poor people, oh my God, what's going to happen to the kids? And, da, 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 da. And they're fine.
Yeah.
So you only came with the bad news.
That's right.
Because
how
that's
many
the
people
way it works.
Have called you out of the blue to say, hey, Sheikh, you're doing a great job. I just appreciate you.
It was funny. Sheikh Yasser Fahmy just said that in my message.
Oh, of course.
How many of you?
Did he say that really?
He did. It was so embarrassing.
But it's true, right? It's like nobody tells you you're doing a good job. Not too many. A few.
Yeah.
One hand, maybe. You know, two hands max. You know, it's just.
And like, I don't say that for me. I would have left anyone's listening.
We're
we say that for the imam, right?
Yeah,
the position,
exactly. And we're talking. Yeah,
the leader.
When it comes to us, listen, we expect the best of ourselves. And we undergo not just legal training, but spiritual training so that we can bear more than most.
Right.
And that comes with the territory.
Well, we got to stay for the next guy.
We got to stay for the next guy, and we got to back each other up, right? Like sometimes, you know, like other things happen with other people. You know, people drag other people's names through the mud, and they say, hey, like, okay, yeah, don't defend yourself. I'm going to defend you, right? Because you're my brother, right? And I know what you're going through, and other people have no idea. Right?
You know, sometimes even better than a word of appreciation, something I never expected, never asked for, but it was just intelligent. It's just professional. My masjid recently instituted, just last year, 2022, they instituted mandatory vacations.
Allahu Akbar.
Right? No rollover allowed.
Allahu Akbar.
You have to rejuvenate.
MashaAllah.
You know, it's like 3 weeks of the year, mandatory.
That's amazing. And that is actually the segue to the next thing I wanted to say, which was like, you know, okay, so there's like protecting the imam and his mental health and, you know, work-life balance and those sorts of things. And there's also, you know, yeah, like, the imam cannot be isolated, right? Like when it comes to whether it's professional development, whether it comes to a network of peers and mentors and things like that, like how many imams stopped talib al-ilm after they became imams? You know, how many actually forgot the Quran that they knew or some of it? Because the responsibilities of being
and
an imam
even
too many.
Fiqh, because only the heart softeners were.
Yeah,
sort of.
Yeah. There's like so much of our training, and so much of it, you know, just like rusts on the shelf because.
Or learning English.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can talk all day about you need to learn English, but when exactly?
Yeah, when is it
English?
Supposed to fit in?
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, just
who's paying this bill and who's carving out that time?
Yeah.
I mean, I think Sheikh. It would benefit even the leadership of Masajid for you to share some thoughts on what the workload of the masjid looks like, which means the imam a lot of times, if he's the only sort of dedicated personality or most visible dedicated person, like what amount of things, not just cycles of conflict, which are enough on their own.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a counselor. Go through the imam.
Oh my God, where do we start? So, okay, depending on the masjid, start with the prayers. Okay, how many prayers is the imam expected to lead per day? How many days a week? Okay, does he have, people don't realize, you know, everybody shows up for their one or two prayers a week. Where's the imam? Akhi, where were you at Fajr? Or where were you like throughout the week, right? If you, especially in a northern latitude where you have like winters, you know, they come together very closely. If you don't even have a weekday where you're not responsible for all the prayers or something like that, when are you supposed to get stuff done? When are you supposed to go to the DMV?
When
are you supposed to have a dentist? Appointment. Like, wait. You don't have any time. Grocery shopping. You know, it's like, you know, these sorts of things.
So that's the religious ritual.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's just one of them, because then you also have Fridays. Okay. Well, that ties down the imam too. He has certain.
You know, you guys prepare for Fridays? You guys don't just switch out of pajamas and talk stuff?
Not just right. Yeah. Like, come on, you just stand up and speak from the heart. No, here's the thing. Okay, here's, you know, back, you know, Joe Bradford gave me the great advice to read a book called Planning Your Preaching before I started being an imam. I have a year plan for my khutbas, okay? And now I don't have the time to implement it as much or plan as much as I would like to.
But the general schematic.
But the general scheme is there. I know when I'm going to hit a series that's going to go through like surahs al-hujurat or, you know, whatever, these khisal, these, you know, characteristics of the pious or something like this, right? The year is planned out. Even the squish time where I'm just going to leave this one blank because there's going to be some relevant topic that's going to come up that I can shift things around, whether Philistine every year, you know, like the Philistine comes up because aggression and or different things like that. Like, this is something that actually takes planning. And this is part of ihsan, right? Because if you leave, you know, like if an imam just gets up and talks about whatever he wants to, you know, then every single just shakhsiya, their personality, they're going to gravitate towards their hobby horse, right? Whatever sort of thing they're passionate about, or they're going to, you know, just whip the same whipping post, you know, every day. So you need a way to balance yourself, and to have a plan is to balance yourself, right? So,
you know, I don't think I've almost ever said this publicly, but may Allah protect us from overconfidence. I know some people appreciate listening to me. Some people out there. Everyone has their audience, I guess, right? And just like I say this about yaqeen as well, so let me not even use myself as the example.
Mm-hmm.
People don't understand what makes yaqeen so appealing, right? They think it's, we just, you know, hired a few like researchers and some volunteers. It is the what's on the back end,
yes,
right?
So much preparation.
Like, maybe at one point I took like a mental snapshot of sort of the budget breakdown they had published out in their annual reports, and maybe 60% of it was engineering, which nobody sees, graphic design, which nobody sees, marketing, and they're not even selling anything, just to get to reach you, get your attention. All of this, same thing with the khutbah.
Yes.
Like, I sit there and say, what haven't I addressed?
Yes, exactly.
What do I address too much?
Yes.
Is this overkill? Am I going to allow someone to get back, grab a slice of pizza, and not get fired in time within that 18, 20 minutes? This takes a whole lot of... How do I respect the intelligence of my audience?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I got doctors and engineers and professors and
moms
who care about, you know, tarbiyah more than I do. And how do I give them what they need in a way they want? It's like, it's a science, right?
Yeah. No, it is. No, it's a real thing. I mean, rhetoric is an art. You know, in and of itself, public speaking is an art, and it's not just
a ritual.
Yeah, so yeah, if we want to just say ritual,
forgive me.
Yeah, ritual, like the hand wave too.
Because I didn't mean one of those. I meant will never end.
Yeah, it'll never end. No, you're right. And you know, we were only talking about daily rituals. Like, listen, I don't know if you guys do like eclipse prayers and stuff like that, but if I had seven of me, right, we would be doing all the eclipse prayers. Right, there's no rain in the summer, it's istisqa and like stuff like that, all the other sunnah that we're probably not covering because we're too burnt out already and our plates are too heavy already, you know. So, you know, ritual worship is enormous. Then, okay, there's pastoral care. Okay, you have people in the hospital, people in ICU, people who are at the palliative care at the end of their lives. Okay, that leads you into janazah territory. Okay, what about when somebody passes away? Who's going to wash the body, prepare the body? Who's going to pray over them? Who's going to be there at the cemetery?
That's like 15 jobs.
We're not even, we haven't even cracked half. Yeah. You know, it's like you've got marriage counseling, divorce counseling. You've got youth counseling, right? We haven't even touched programming. That isn't even programming, right? It's like now we also, because every masjid, I think when they come around to the need for an imam, they're thinking about all of the programs they want to have. And they're like, well, we want to have a program for the youth. That's usually where they start thinking. And programs for the women.
And he gets hit by a torpedo before he gets to the programs.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what programs? Like, yeah. Like, again, and this is why, you know, I try to tell people, like, nonprofits are a sector. It's an industry sector. Like, any industry sector, if you're in medicine, you're in engineering, it's a whole area. There are books. There are best practices. There are industry standards. There is a thing called capacity. And what happens is our masajid do not understand the concept of capacity. And then you hire an imam and you expect the capacity to just come from the imam.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we're going to be able to get everybody married, get everybody a match, find somebody to get married in the first place, keep that marriage together, handle the divorce, handle the death, handle the births, run youth programs, run women's programs, run programs for the elderly, right? Suhbah, social events, right? And da'wah to the non-Muslims around us, our neighbors, our open houses, our things like that. And local politics, the school boards and the city council and the stuff like that, and liaison with who we need to get the easement or the permission to make the adhan out loud or whatever, all these relationships that need to be built. Whoa, 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 whoa. Shay.
I'm going to send you an invoice for this therapy session.
Yeah, no, no, say nothing. Akhi, I mean,
and
come
you
on.
Forgot that you have to take them to Hajj Umrah and Aqsa.
Whoa, yeah, how exactly. Dare you, Shaykh. Shaykh, like, what is this? And
Dr.
seriously.
Dr. Muhammad Abu Talib actually visited our community, and he's a very systems guy, and I just benefit so much from just sparking him and letting him speak, especially behind closed doors. And he says, you know, you guys, think about this. Like, all of the things you mentioned back home are not done by the imam. Why? Not because there's another person doing it. There's an entire government-funded ministry behind
yes.
it.
Yes.
Like, education is not the masjid. It's yep. the education ministry.
Yeah.
Tax dollars or wherever they get the money.
Yeah.
Right? Janazah ministry. Right? The Hajj and Umrah, you go and apply and get your situated with your package through a minute. All this dovetails into the masjid. And if the masjid has an imam, he's just going to be the go-to. So let me not forget to ask you, how do we begin fixing this? How do we get some of this off the imam's shoulders?
Yes. People in the masjid need to realize that it's about building capacity, and the imam is only one ingredient in building capacity. And depending on the skills and the qualifications of the imam, that the imam might be even more of an asset when it comes to helping you build capacity than actually providing that capacity itself, right? Okay. So when it comes to leadership, you know, leadership is not just about doing everything yourself. It's not about being the boss and the guy that's in charge. Leadership is about putting other people in places where they can succeed and develop. And so a successful imam and a successful leader, and there's others that have, you know, that know way more about this than I do. I'm just, you know, mubtadi. I'm just like just starting like to educate myself about this sort of stuff, is somebody who's going to delegate and cultivate people and recruit people and maintain people, right? They say for volunteerism, the three R's, what is it? Recruit, retain, recognize, right? Other people to build the capacity of the masjid. They say in leadership books, that it's like the 80-20 rule, right? If somebody can do something 80% as good as you, then you have to delegate it to them, because the imam needs to be freed up to do those things that only that person can do. Somebody told me, I think it was Ibrahim Hindi, when I was up in Toronto, and you were recently in Toronto, he told me of an imam in Toronto that missed a prayer in the masjid, leading a prayer, because he had to meet the mayor of Toronto for something that was happening with the Muslim community. And the masjid was upset at him. They were upset. They were angry at the imam for going to this instead of that. You know, like, who else would you have liked to meet the mayor? If you're talking about delivering a message, who knows? Now we got all this crazy stuff coming through the schools with the curriculum and stuff like that. We're trying to get Eid recognized as a holiday. We're trying to, you know, angle for real things that are going to affect the lives of Muslims. Who do you want there? Who's the only person that can do it? If the imam, you should have the imam spending their time and the things that only he can do. And then when it comes to everybody else, janazas, washing the bodies, like, you know, whatever, even marriage counseling, most imams, we're not qualified to counsel. We're not counselors. We didn't have any training for that, most of us, right? It has to be somebody else.
And even if we did, we're going to have to choose between being this or that.
Yeah, right? Unless you're going to pay for two salaries, right? It's like we don't have the capacity or the time or the energy or the whatever to be able to do all that stuff. So you need to now look at it as building capacity and personnel. And your raw material is all the people in your community who can step up to do the work, right? And do a good enough job and take instruction and take, you know, be managed, right? Like by the imam, by the board or whatever, whoever's running the stuff. It's got to be everybody.
So we got to recruit, retain, recognize.
And recognize.
So we have to say thank you in that.
Yeah, you do. You do.
Yeah, but recruiting, I mean, there are a lot of people out there. One of the interesting things I noticed just through personal experience is that there are people out there that want to be part of something bigger than themselves.
Yes.
They have deep love for not just sense of accomplishment, but just for the dean as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some misfires actually in the beginning, because I remember asking one brother, he hates me for always repeating this story, one of my inner circle closest brothers. I asked him to help out with civic engagement, mm-hmm. social welfare, and feeding mm-hmm. and pantries and things like this for 2 years straight. Mm-hmm. And he was always busy, and he was genuinely busy. And then COVID happened, and we had to go virtual. And so he created these episodes
mm-hmm.
that were very well done, like just snippet clips for our community. And then when I started noticing the quality of the episodes, I was like, bro, how long did it take you to make these episodes? He was making them on his phone, on iMovie, right? He would come record me with two phones.
No
and
way.
He would, I swear. I said, how long does it take you to make it? And he says, oh, about 12 hours a day. He made the time. He was running on fumes. And so I think part of recruitment is that people out there want to help.
Mm-hmm.
If you just do what the Prophet ﷺ did, right? Ibn Abbas, may Allah give you interpretive skills.
Yeah.
Mu'adh, you're good, you know, in the judicial, domain. Abu Huraira, you got time and you have memory, and I'll make an extra dua for you. And don't forget anything I say. Recruiting the right way mm-hmm. for the right thing. Just spend a little bit of time. It'll be such a relief mm-hmm. for everybody.
Yeah.
And then you retain them by making sure you actually let go of the steering wheel a little bit.
I was going to say, that's where actually the masjid needs to take a step back and either let the imam handle it or somehow get out of the way. Because what happens a lot of times, the masajid micromanage the volunteers like they micromanage
and
the
no
imam.
One wants to be a cog in the engine.
No, of course, exactly. And every community has had that problem. You have volunteers, you finally get them to show up, it's confusing, they don't know what they're supposed to do, there's mixed messages, whatever, and then they don't feel like they had any impact.
Yeah,
well, if you show up and you actually dedicate your time, it's like, like masjids are not like businesses, but there's a couple important ways in which they are like businesses. If you show up to a business, let's say like you get your coffee at some place, you go there and the door is closed and it's locked, even though it said it was supposed to be open, your chances of going back to that place are much reduced, which is why I'm such a huge proponent of like keep the masjid open, especially during the daytime. Right. And then.
But even that costs money, Sheikh, without diverting you. Right.
Again, like
security
priority.
Issues.
Again, priorities.
Right.
Priorities.
Right, right.
If it's a priority, if you make it a
priority. No, I'm just highlighting that you don't mean that in sort of like just keep it open. Right?
No. It has to be done properly with safely. We have our women that might be in there, things like that. But it's like.
You're saying do whatever it takes.
Do what it takes to do it right.
To resource keeping it open.
Yeah, of course. And the same thing with volunteers. It's like you get somebody, you finally break through and you get them out of bed and you get them to the place, at the time and ready to do the thing. And then they have a bad experience. They're not going to come back. Most of them. Most people won't.
So that's retain. And then recognize.
And recognize, whether it's just, we have our community events and our city, it can be, there's a million ways to do it.
Invite them all out to a dinner or a lunch.
Or coffee or whatever. Could it be, even an invite over the house, there's so many ways to do it. Just a little bit of thought. And that's the thing that matters. It's not about, like cash prizes or like whatever, right. Like any sort of like whatever. It's just they like to know that it's the thought that counts. The fact that somebody took the time, and we can't hide behind the, you should have just done it for Allah and like whatever. Okay, yeah. But also, whoever doesn't thank the people doesn't thank Allah. Yeah. You have to make the person realize that you thought about them and, you appreciate what they offered.
So that'll free up, inshallah, the capacity or grow the capacity of the community and free up the imam to be able to do what only he can do and was trained for. Let me try to ask you to be a little bit introspective here.
Oh, yeah, sure.
To close out. Where should we... ask the imams to self-regulate,
mm-hmm.
both in terms of not the power grab, but how much influence they should expect to have as masajid begin to grow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I was telling one brother recently, he's like, how didn't I know X or Y or Z? I was like, this is a sign of a growing masjid.
Yep.
That there's going to be things that even I don't know.
Yep.
Right? And so where are you responsible versus accountable versus consulted versus informed, just like everyone else, right?
Right.
Because sometimes there is, I believe, unjustified. It's a two-way street, right? Mm-hmm. Even from the religious leadership, grievances.
Yeah.
Maybe because there's so many legitimate grievances that wholesale this one gets picked up as well. And even personally, not just in terms of the power and influence that the imam should wield, but self-regulation, how much they should ensure for themselves that they don't burn out, they don't walk out.
Yeah.
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah, no, it's a huge thing. I mean, and that's why having a peer network is so important, you know, and I've benefited from, you know, my peers and mentors tremendously. But, you know, even then, you know, like I had people like coaching me through the contract process and stuff like that. Here's what you asked for. Here's what you need, like, et cetera, et cetera. And that helped tremendously. However, it still wasn't enough. Like there's some things that, you know, looking back on it. Yeah. It's like one mistake I made was letting people have my phone number. Everybody has my phone number and I just stopped taking calls. I don't answer the phone anymore at all. If somebody texts me. Huh?
You too?
Yeah, no, at all. And then people are upset at you. And like, I even had like some brother say, you broke my heart. I said, I'm sorry. Like, I'm not going to respond to every single call, it was like
either you or my wife.
Yeah, no, seriously, Habibi. It's like, you can be brokenhearted. I'd rather have you brokenhearted than my wife brokenhearted. Like,
unless, you know, Sheikh, I'm so sorry. Please don't lose train of thought. But someone pointed out this nuance. It was so amazing. It's with the Hujurat. Allah said to those calling out from behind the walls, intruding, right?
Yeah.
وَلَوْ أَنَّهُمْ صَبَرُوا if they would have just waited حَتَّى تَخْرُجَ until you came out. He didn't say came out. He said came out to them. So even if I'm visible, even if I'm accessible, even if you have my number, but I'm not available for you right now, don't be deceived by my perceived access.
Exactly. And then even with the prayers, you know, there was a time, you know, where like I would be discouraged from coming to the masjid because I knew I was going to catch it from somebody, you know, somebody who's going to bother me about a particular issue or they have like whatever. And so it's like, you don't even want to come to the masjid, subhanAllah, as the imam, you know.
I know a brother in Louisiana, imam there, who said to me, I live across the parking lot from the masjid, so I can't not pray at the masjid on my day off. His day off was Mondays. He said, but I refuse to lead on my day off. I don't think I agree with him, but I understand the sentiment.
Yeah, no, there have been times where lead skip town.
And tell them this is my day off.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry.
Exactly. No, I mean, something about boundaries. Like, that's the idea. Okay. And the particulars of it, you know, are going to look different from place to place. But it's like, you know, if I come into the masjid on a day off or even on a particular day, people assume when they see you that they have access to you. Like, that's just what comes with the territory as an imam. And then people drag you into either debates or problems or whatever. And then, you know, as imams, we hope that we're a little bit conscientious, right? And like sympathetic. You know, you have some people who are converts and some people who are whatever. But being able to distinguish a true emergency from a not so emergency situation. And to be like, you know, at this point, like at this particular time, I have to go. I don't have time to stay. Like, you can follow up with so-and-so or whatever, you know, or if there's somebody else to delegate, it's like, if you're looking for this, you know, like either liaison with a new convert or something like this, somebody needs the ABCs or whatever. It's like, we have brother so-and-so. Here's how you can reach him. Or, you know, the other thing is, a lot of people come to the imam complaining about stuff that he has no control over when it comes to like the administration or things like that with the masjid. Parking lots and whatever, and fire escapes, whatever it is. And it's like, okay, that's an issue for the administration. You can talk to the administration and masalama. You know, definitely wish I had done a better job of drawing those boundaries when I first came. And I had to swing to the other side, you know, in order to kind of hastily erect some boundaries.
Some fences.
Some fences or brick walls or whatever. I actually got like a new phone, new SIM, like whatever. So now my old number is like my work number. And I haven't gotten graded yet, but I'm going to get to the point where I actually just like turn it off, like when I'm not working. So it'll be on when I'm in work.
I have the second phone, but I'm still struggling with the clean pivot.
I'm pivoting. I'm in that transition phase as well.
I mean, you reminded me of a few things. I'll share them quickly, and then I'll ask you to close us out with any final thoughts and a dua. I mean, in case any of the imams are spying in on this episode, this Blueprints episode, I don't counsel anymore.
Yeah, couples at all.
Right. So what I do is I give them one session. And my whole objective from the session is to convince them that these are symptoms. These are not the core issue. You need a counselor to actually fix it.
Yep.
Here's a list. Because,
yep.
you know, there are taboos and stigmas and all that. That was the first thing. The second thing is I learned seeing some of the busier religious leaders of the country when we asked them to consult them on certain charity projects and otherwise throughout the years we were doing or conference projects. He said, yeah, absolutely, I'm at your service. Then we sat down. He said, listen, this meeting will end in 60 minutes from the get-go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that puts the onus on you now to trim the fat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
you need to get to your priorities because I'm giving you 60 minutes of my time. And that was very useful, actually.
MashaAllah.
Maybe the third and last thing is when I did a little bit of marital counsel training, I went to a crash course and some, you know, it wasn't even like a certificate program or anything. One of the coolest things he said to us is, I know you feel the pressure as like caretaker of your community that when someone comes to you panicking, I have to sympathize. I have to figure it out. He says, unless there's clear and imminent danger, that's called 911. He says, you actually will never succeed when they're emotionally charged at helping. So get rid of the guilt of answering the call.
Allahu Akbar. That's nice.
That's great advice. You know, because you're saying, I gotta help them. You will never help them if they're calling you 8 times in a row. That means they're not there in the right state of mind.
Yes,
don't feel guilty calling them back in 3 days.
MashaAllah.
I was like, oh man,
that's wonderful.
Thank you.
You know what? A little thing I benefited from Sheikh Yasha. He said, Sheikh Yasha Birjas, he has like, it's literal and figurative. He said, sometimes you just have to push the tissue box across the table.
I've heard him say that.
And I was like, yes, I am. Like, that's true.
He said, I used to cry with them.
Yes.
And then after a while, I'm just
here's
like.
Here's the tissues. Yeah, here you go. No, I mean.
Do your thing.
But that's a metaphor.
I'm taking
for
notes.
But that's a metaphor for the whole orientation towards it. Because I think, I like to think that as imams, green imams, we first came in, you know, we want to save the world. We want to save every soul. We want to save every person. And that's just not possible. And it's not sustainable. Not like that. You know, so sometimes you have to. What do they say? You know, when everybody says the when you take a flight, you know, and the mask drops.
Your mask first.
Save yourself first, so that you can save others. Yeah. And it might be a crisis with a lot of imams. Like, you know, you have to save yourself first if you want to help anybody else.
What about the power factor?
Power.
Where should you recognize where you're not drained?
Yeah, I mean, I think. Alhamdulillah,
fair
like
is fair.
In my experience, I haven't seen too many imams power tripping. My experience is that most imams are very conscientious people, which is good. We don't want to have the other problem.
The deen should produce that on some level.
It should, right? I think where imams, and you said half of it, overstep from most of what I see is with the counseling aspect. We're not trained as counselors, most of us, so don't touch it. You know, to be honest, refer to a professional. And politics, you know, and that comes with both speaking and advocating. You know, if you don't know about politics, shut your mouth. I'll say that just because we're.
Yeah, feel relieved for the time being that it's haram for you to speak on it.
Don't make it your thing.
Don't
make it your thing. Like my first degree is in political science, and there's people now, it's 2023. There's people now that are coming out and apologizing and saying, you know, it's whatever, because, you know, they probably shouldn't have been talking about certain political issues, alliances with this group and that group and whatever. And now there's nadama. You know, it's like you didn't have any training in politics. You didn't understand what politics were. But I can sympathize as an imam. You're pushed into this thing where people are looking to you unfairly, expecting.
But you got to know yourself.
You got to know yourself. And if you don't have the training, it's not like, you know, everybody has an opinion about stuff. That doesn't mean like this is a fen, you know, it's its own sort of thing. And if you don't have the training, just be, you know, like it'd be like me trying to, you know, talk about medicine. You know, I have absolutely no clue about anything like with medicine or things like that. It's like I'm not even going to walk through that door. So politics is the same, you know.
SubhanAllah. I read for one of the Salaf. Of course, this was said in the context of taqwa, of piety. But subhanAllah, you just extended it to so many other domains. He said, the most ignorant person is the one who forgets his certainty about himself due to people's assumptions of him. So you need to know where you stand. Self-aware, self-cognizant, very important, subhanAllah. Jazakallah khair for your time. So much to talk on, and inshallah the following episodes will close out some of these gaps, and forgive us if we've taken from your time or your family's time on a short visit passing through impromptu with this podcast.
Alhamdulillah, this was wonderful. Wonderful opportunity. May Allah make it a source of benefit for ourselves as a reminder, and for the Ummah and the Masajid, inshallah. May Allah use us as instruments of His, you know, plan for something that pleases Him, inshallah.
Ameen. Jazakallah khairan. Jazakallah khair to the team, the podcast team, everybody who's coming out early mornings and late nights and making this happen. May Allah make this heavy, and may you find the compensation for it in your lives, in your afterlives, in your family, in your loved ones. Allahumma ameen. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam wa baraka nabiyyina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in.